Following, we'd like to first of all thank Mr. Abi Najjar, who is sponsoring this Shir Le'ilui Nishmas, his brother Moshe ben Harav Chaim Halevi, whose first yahrzeit was just this past week. Nishmosa Eden, he should be a melis yosher for the entire Mishpacha Abi. We want to thank Barbara and Jack Siegel, who are sponsoring the two yahrzeits. Barbara's father is Yosef Meir ben Mordechai Halevi, and Jack's sister, Sima Shimona, Basilizana Zishra Halevi as well. Mirza Hashem, they should have an Ilui Neshama from our Limud and your continued mitzvahs and Torah in this world. We are also learning Ilui Nishmas Avi Hoshlander's grandmother, whose Shiva we are in, Sarah Bas Frieda, just passed away this last week. Her neshama should have an aliyah. She should be mitzvah yeshara for the mishpacha always. So the topic today is entitled Jewish mindfulness, and we shouldn't forget the question mark. So let's try it again: Jewish mindfulness. And the reason why this is a bit of a contrived topic, let's try to admit why this is a bit of a problematic name for a topic is can anybody, as Hillel just pointed out to me, can anybody translate the topic? Now, we can't really translate the word mindfulness very easily. It's a mindless topic, exactly. So this is an interesting topic, and part of the reason why this is fascinating is in recent years, you know, one of the flash words of recent times is mindfulness. You see it everywhere: mindfulness books, mindfulness eating, mindfulness yoga, mindfulness meditations, mindfulness exercises. There's so many aspects of mindfulness, and there are numerous books that you can buy on the topic from experts and some non-experts who are all contributing to the general proliferation of mindfulness in today's day and age. And so it's a little bit of an awkward question sort of asking about Jewish mindfulness, because in truth be told, we haven't really fully defined the term mindfulness in secular society. There was a rather controversial article which was released a year ago in the New York magazine. I just copied the beginning over here, and the title was called "The Muddied Meaning of Mindfulness." Obviously, the person who was writing the article had an agenda, and you can even read it just in the first paragraph of the article. You can get a sense of the edge of cynicism in the author's writing. And what this lady argues is that, you know, really the earliest we can really track it back to is in the 19th century, when there was a gentleman whose name was Thomas William Rides Davids. He must have been British, right? It was a part of the colonial arm of then the Victorian British Empire, who was sent to Sri Lanka and part of his job was adjudicating trials between different sects of Buddhists. And at that point in time, he used the word mindfulness, which was really a synonym for attention, as she says, which was used a little earlier as well. But here he sort of was extracting it from a concept at the top of the second column on page one. He says the translation was indeed rough. It was from a Buddhist word called sati. Sati, which Buddhists consider the first of the seven factors of enlightenment, mean more nearly memory of the present, which doesn't track into the tense, preoccupied English. Mindfulness stuck, but may have saddled the subtle sati with false note connotations of Victorian caution or even obedience. So what she points out is, you know, sort of we sort of pulled it from a very unusual place, and then it means different things to different people, and everybody kind of has their own definition of it. And so she sort of ends the article on this kind of, you know, question mark note that we don't really know what it is. Everybody sort of rides with this word and popularizes it and, you know, and turns into their consumer good depending on what they want from it. So, you know, so to ask ourselves, you know, so does Judaism fit into a word which we haven't really fully understood yet is kind of a meaningless activity. However, truth be told, as critical as this article is, one should read the reviews from Mindful, one of the primary websites which deals with mindfulness. And what the arguments are is that that you're right. As with any new idea or idea which is, we're calling, evolving from the East into the West, there's going to be different applications and people are going to apply it differently. But there's a core of, we'll call it truth, which applies itself, and everybody agrees about that, and that is transformative. What is that? So the definition, the working definition today of mindfulness on the top of the next pages of the Merriam-Webster Dictionary is as follows. I love the first. The first part always, you always have to have one of these in every dictionary, is the quality or state of being mindful. You know, that just transforms our understanding. So the second part is the more important, is the practice of maintaining a non-judgmental state of heightened or complete awareness of one's thoughts, emotions, or experiences on a moment-to-moment basis. Okay, the most important word over there is, or the most important words over here is, a non-judgmental state of heightened and complete awareness. A person is absorbing reality without judging or responding to reality around oneself. Okay, one is absorbing, one is experiencing, as opposed to thinking and projecting oneself into the reality around oneself. And that applies itself in numerous different fields. In fact, part of the reason why I started thinking about this recently was, I was at CVS recently, and there was a magazine there by the counter which looked really interesting. It was Time Magazine's special edition for 2016, and the topic was the mindfulness revolution. It's the only magazine that one could possibly look at anymore, and that are standing by the counters. That's not talking about the most recent affair between celebrities and the terrible lives that they lead, or people who are trying to unclothe themselves publicly in the magazine covers. So it's actually nice to see a magazine which one can actually buy. And I took this magazine home. And again, a magazine is not a PhD dissertation, so you know we don't have the full encompassing perspective of things. But nonetheless, there were some very interesting articles in that magazine. And Time Magazine did a sort of a 360 on a lot of these topics. And here's some examples of mindfulness in its expression today. And it gives us pause to think. So here's a few articles that I noticed in this magazine. One is, we're talking about technology, of course. Technology today. He did some interesting research. On the second page here, this is an article by a man called Malcolm Hyde. And the article is talking about alert overload. This is something very interesting. And I think these 2 points that he makes are very worthwhile thinking about. Number one, the top left column, alert overload. He says, one recent study found that it can take your brain 15 to 25 minutes to get back to where it was after stopping to check an email. And Miller's own research shows that you don't get better at this sort of multitasking with practice. In fact, people who judge themselves to be expert digital multitaskers tend to be pretty bad at it, he says. You're not able to think as deeply on something when you're distracted every few minutes, Miller notes, and thinking deeply is where insights come from. So this is just an important point, is that, when we're working, how many tabs do we have open? How many different browsers do we have open? How many devices do we have on the desk with different tabs open, with different apps open, so meaning to say, and therefore we should sort of track ourselves and sort of wonder to ourselves, how long are we actually honed in on one activity anymore? How long is it before we need to sort of flip to another activity in order to sort of right ourselves? We're talking about productivity diminishment, right? So if we have employees, if we are an employee, right, a lot of time is being lost. And we can maybe even give this a dollar amount if you want to think about the time and then the time value of the lost time of productivity of employees based on this. It's no longer solitaire, if you know what I'm saying. It's a little more complex because it's always coming in. On the top of the let's say the bottom of the column over here on the left, finding focus. Your ability to focus aside, 2014 study appearing in the journal PLOS-1 found that people who spend a lot of time media multitasking or juggling lots of different websites, apps, or programs or other digital stimuli tend to have less gray matter in a part of their brain involved with the thought and emotion control. These same structural changes are associated with obsessive compulsive disorder, depression, and anxiety disorders, says the study's first author, Kepke Loh, who conducted his research in the University College of London. Ashley says that that research suggests that lots of device use bombards your brain's prefrontal cortex, which plays a role in the willpower and decision making. The prefrontal cortex prevents us from doing stupid things, whether it's eating junk food or texting while driving, he explains. So meaning to say that when you're not exercising, it's like muscles that you're just leaving without actually stimulating, right? So that muscle section is going to now sort of be limp. It's not going to be developed. So when we're multitasking, we're not really focusing on penetrating insight. And I think we can think about this. The next time we come to, let's say you have to let's say research a particular article, and you come to a difficult passage, and you need to give a critique, you need to write a report, or you need to respond to a board about a particular idea, and you come to something which is difficult, what's your first response? So catch yourself, sort of take a step outside of yourself. Is your first response to think about it more deeply, or to Google the ideas, or to look for similar articles? Meaning we use lateral thinking. We sort of, because there's so much information out there, we move sideways as opposed to moving deeper. You notice that? It's very hard to actually think. I've had an opportunity of learning a little bit with Rabbi Foreman recently. And one of the things that Rabbi Foreman does is that when he encounters a roadblock, he doesn't try to laterally move around the roadblock. He tries to dig deeper. It's a lost art, thinking, meaning to actually have to confront this. So this is one aspect, the digital realm. Just turn the page for a second, without reading it inside here. In terms of, this is an article called Can You Shed Pounds on Mindfulness Diets by Kathleen Malpeter. She there was research which was done where they took, this is actually very recent in the journal Obesity from this year, where they took 200 people who are obese technically, and they put them on diets, and half the group they gave information about the nutritional and exercise value that they were doing, and the other half they taught them mindfulness exercises, appreciating the eating as they're doing it, appreciating the taste, the experience. And what they found was that they lost equal amounts of weight at the end of the program, but there was longer adherence to it 6 months later. And in fact, the research showed that there was greater cholesterol and lower levels of triglycerides in the group that was mindful 6 months after the research was done. So this research was pointing in the direction that mindfulness is perhaps more of a critical factor in the dieting experience than simply just what one's doing itself. Another example in a different realm. Save Yourself from Stress. There's another article over here. This is very interesting. This article is actually talking more about working mothers and like sort of the different stresses that are played on working mothers. But it's interesting because it has so many ramifications to everybody. And just to take a look at this is on the right hand article on page 3. And this is just something worth paying attention to. Why does stress have physical effects on its mental think? If it's a mental thing, so the bottom left corner, he says, forget your tyrant boss, blame the woolly rhinoceros. Stress activates physiological response. The mind perceives a threat of emergency and your body reacts, according to Michael McKee, who is a psychologist at the Cleveland Clinic. You're probably familiar with the fight or flight effect. Your system churns out stress chemicals, adrenaline, I'm not 100% sure, norepinephrine. Thank you. What?
Norepinephrine.
Thank you. All the physicians in the world. And cortisol, causing your heart to race and blood pressure to increase as oxygen goes to your large muscles. So he was talking about how sort of we're wired to have a response to stress. But what happens is in today's day and age, where we're not running into the caves, you know, from the saber-toothed tigers anymore, you know, in the sort of evolutionary way of looking at things as they talk about it. So then in this case, when we encounter mild stress, like, you know, we're planning the Thanksgiving dinner where we're going to have lots of people around the table, which is, you know, we do every Friday night kind of thing. But like, you know, when it experiences those stresses so that it sets off all these chemicals in the body, and these chemicals, when they're circulating in the body, have negative effects. And she goes through a numerous effects that the body has by carrying these stresses on a day-to-day basis. So if there's no discharge, if there's no awareness of these things. So, you know, like, you know, you read all these articles and you say to yourself, wouldn't it be nice, you know, in our busy lives, if we had a little bit of time, wouldn't it be nice if we could just, you know, practice some of the techniques they talk about over here, perhaps some of the basic meditations, perhaps some of the grounding, some of the exercise techniques, some of the thinking techniques that they talk about over here. Wouldn't it be nice if we just had a little bit of time in the day, you know? Judaism doesn't seem to speak about it too much, and we don't really have so much time to do it, but wouldn't it be nice if we had this time? What I'd like to argue is that, you know, this is wonderful, you know, and it's great to see that research is catching up. But in the end of the day, you know, Judaism spoke about this long, long, long beforehand. This topic is so vast in Judaism that it is foolish to think that we could even address it in the time that we have. However, and in fact, just by the way, Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, somebody sent me an article on Friday. Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg from Boca actually gave his Shabbos Shuvah Drasha on mindfulness, and his packet was 44 pages long. Very fascinating. You know, and there's much more than 44 pages. There's so much. We could take it from a look on the we go to the Sifrei Musar and talk about the notion of being present. We could go to, you know, historically, there's so many different ways we could look at this particular idea. Just as an example, just to throw this out. The Gemara in Sukkah says about Hillel. It says Tanya Amru Lolov Al Hillel Azake in source 2. Omar Ken Hillel would say the following statement: "If I'm here, I'm fully here. If I'm not, then nobody else. If I'm here, then everybody's here. If I'm not here, nobody's here." Which is kind of like an arrogant-sounding statement, and really needs a little bit of adjusting, seeing as Hillel was not a person who was egotistical. as is clear from his statements in Pirkei Avos. And Rav Nissen Alpert, Zichron Levracha, who was one of the Rosh Yeshiva, YU, and the prime Talmud of Rav Moshe Feinstein, says a very, very basic insight. Imani kan, when I am here, hakol kan, all of me is here. That's what we're saying. Imani kan, if I've decided to be in one place, if I decided to be in a meeting, I am in this meeting. If I decided to go out on a date with my wife, I am 100% in the date with my wife. If I decided that I'm going to play with the kids or the grandkids, I'm 100% in that place. That's what Hillel will say. Which now, that, and we could go through numerous tiers of levels in Judaism where we see such thinking. But the first of all, we don't have the time for that right now. But what I'd like to do is, I'd like to just do one transformative idea and learn that with you today. And that is to understand that the concepts of mindfulness itself, or the basic concepts or kernels, are ever present in Judaism, but not as something which was response to the times as, oh, well, you know, that sounds good and we should also have that kind of thing, but more as something which really was part of our tradition from age old. Part of the ideas that I'd like to talk about in the next few moments are the ideas of Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan has a number of books, and I really highly recommend anything he writes. He is one unbelievably prolific and incisive individual. You know when we throw around the term, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that. You know, a rocket scientist, so he was a nuclear physicist. He was a rocket scientist. He was, you know, you don't meet rocket scientists that often, but he was one of them. And he was an incredibly intelligent individual. At the same time as being intelligent, it wasn't simply ivory tower intelligence, it was practical intelligence as well. And he writes a number of books. One book he writes is called Jewish Meditation. And it's really a transformative look at tefillah. It really is a transformative look at tefillah. I'd recommend it highly. He has another book which I just started reading recently called Meditation in the Bible. You know, when we hear the word meditation, we kind of like, you know, we have our biases. So we kind of, you know, if we do an image association, no doubt that many of us would sort of, you know, think about that person in the orange robe sitting in a lotus position on the top of a mountain, right? And that's kind of like, you know, we dismiss it in that, you know, Judaism is Judaism and meditation is Eastern. And, you know, we kind of disassociate ourselves from those kind of things. But he has just in his introduction to the book, he has this a basic thing to think about. Meditation. Let's just do a very simple exercise just for 5 seconds. And that is, well, let's do 10 seconds. For the next 10 seconds, just stop thinking. Very uncomfortable feeling. You have to stop thinking. Do you feel that as you try to stop thinking, you manage to get maybe a second or two where you sort of clear the floors and then things start seeping in again? Whether it be pictures, words, whether it may even be counting the time to get to the end of it. Meditation isn't necessarily about a person who's sitting in a meditational state, but essentially control of the mind. Being able to control what we're thinking and how we're thinking it, what flows through our mind, how we allow what to throw from our mind. Are we transparent? Can we focus on a particular word? Can we focus on concept? Can we defocus? Can we allow noise to pass through us? How in control of our minds we are. That's a very Jewish concept, interestingly enough. Listen to the way he describes it, and this is so important, because you say, well, if that's true, well, why haven't we been hearing about it? Meaning, why hasn't Judaism been shouting this for centuries? And the answer is it has. Take a look at this. Is in chapter 5 in Jewish Meditation. He says, there is ample evidence that meditative practices were widespread among Jews throughout the Jewish history, meaning the focus of the mind. References to meditation are found in major Jewish texts in every period from biblical to pre-modern era. One reason that this has not been universally recognized is the vocabulary of meditation has been lost to a large degree, especially during the last century. He talks about that as the Enlightenment arose, the Enlightenment de-emphasized the more Kabbalistic, we'll call it the thoughts, the inner parts of Judaism, and rose the intellectual part of Judaism, which means in the last 150 years we've lost the concepts or tools or words of understanding what these focus, mind-focused words were in Judaism. So you just we skip down a little bit to the smaller lines beforehand. He says, for this and other reasons, all references to meditation, this is the second last paragraph, have vanished from Jewish literature from about 150 years ago. This is true even in Hasidic literature, where meditation initially played a central role. Because of this anti-mystical trend, even Kabbalistic works published around 1840 show a surprising lack of the slightest mention of meditation. After a century of indifference, even the meaning of the key words were forgotten. Interesting, right? He says, in earlier literature, by contrast, references to meditation are abundant. This is true even in the Bible, although one has to resort to the kind of verbal archaeology to discover the true meaning of key words. In any case, it appears that both biblical and post-biblical sources that meditation was central to the prophetic experience, and this experience was attained in a meditative state. And he goes on to say that I explain this in Meditation in the Bible, which is the other book, which is a very fascinating book, which is on the top of the next page. And he says in it, what he does is he sort of goes through and he shows you what those words are. When you're reading Tanakh, what do certain words mean? When you read through the Rishonim and the Gaonim, and they talk about certain words, what do they mean? What does it mean when Rav Hai Gaon, when the Rambam, when the Ramban talk about Hisboidedus, Hisboinenus, Hislamdus, Siach, Sha'ah? What does it mean when the Bible uses certain words? What does it mean? I was just talking recently, I had a conversation with Hillel about Sela. Sela, Rav Hirsch says, Sela is a moment to think backwards, as this is a stopping point in the Bible in Tehillim, to say, let's think about what you just said, what you just experienced. If we are able to sort of look at the dictionary again about where these thought-controlled, or we'll call it fully present, experiences are to be found in the Bible, he says, and he goes through it with sources at the end of every parak, you will see what's actually going on. He has an example here in Meditation in the Bible here in the third source on page 5. He says, the second paragraph on the left, a number of biblical verses are seen by Rabbi Avraham. He's talking about Avraham ben Arambam, who wrote prolifically on this topic, as referring to such meditative state. It is the perfection from within the heart for which King David prayed when he says, Lev Tahar Barali Elohim. What does a Lev Tahar mean? He's saying a Lev Tahar means to say a heart which is fully focused. Hashem created for me a heart which is fully 100% there. It was also the attainment of Asaph, he goes, which he sang in Tehillim, to Ayin Gimel, my flesh and my heart fade away while God becomes the rock of my heart and my portion forever. I mean to say that this is full focus. These verses refer to the purity of mind and heart when they are cleansed of all things other than the divine. And he goes on for many, many, many psukim to show where this appears from. And he talks about the word nevuah, the word siach, how all these all connected, neshima, neshama. Very fascinating work. Now, if you think about this for a moment, it really isn't as foreign as we'd imagine. You know, like last night I was learning with my sons. We had the first night of parent-child, when it's getting a little earlier. And I was chatting with them about, you know, Avraham Avinu and Noach. And like, how is it that Avraham Avinu discovered God? You know, like, so the first response naturally from the children was, well, he followed God's commandments, his mitzvahs. But the problem was that God didn't give mitzvahs then. So he listened to the Torah, but there was no Torah. So what exactly was Avraham Avinu doing? How was he this special person, this tzaddik who was of this generation? How did he get there? So there's numerous midrashim, which describe, you know, the palace in flames, the way he looked at the wind and the clouds and the moon and the sun and the rivers and all the different aspects of creation. But if we think about that deeply, what's really going on? Where did the answer really lie with Avraham Avinu? The answer is that Avraham Avinu, all the answers are actually inside, if you think about it. The way the Rambam describes, the Rambam has, although the Rambam in his book Yad, which is his 14 sections of Halacha, is primarily Halacha Shava, and there are certain sections where he sort of lets himself give, you know, a little bit of history of things. One example is the beginning of Hilchas Avodah Zarah. The Rambam describes how the world mutated from a place where God sort of created humanity, and then they sort of turned their back on God. Like, how did that happen? How could it happen so fast? How did we get to a flood within such a short span of time in terms of generations, not in terms of years? And the Rambam describes how people started attributing power to God's ministers. So, you know, they were uncomfortable dealing with Hashem, so they started dealing with his intermediaries. The sun is very powerful after all. There are other ministers, there are other powerful forces in the world. So if we give them respect as subsidiaries of God, ultimately that would be good, because we don't have to feel so, you know, uncomfortable in the face of this all-powerful, all-knowing God. We can deal with the sun, it's much easier, and then they sort of slowly forgot the boss, right? So then he describes, Aaron goes through this whole long description. On page 7, he comes back to the description of the word. I left it in here just because it's really worthwhile to consider for ourselves. We're not going to go through it all, but the Rambam says, on page 7, the paragraph says, talks about the birth of Abraham. So he says, Kevon shenigmal Eitan Zeh. When this young, strong person, his name was Eitan Ezrachi, was one of the names of Avraham Avinu, was Nigmal, he was weaned, Hischil l'shotet b'da'atoy, he started thinking. V'ukoton, he was young. He would think day and night. This is back to Aristotelian thought that the earth is the epicenter with all the stars and planets in various rings around it. But whichever way it is, it's still relevant to us. He started saying, well, how does it all move? You know, who set up the system that's in perpetual motion? There's nobody pushing it. It's impossible that it pushes itself. Now, that itself is very fascinating to us. We'd sort of fine tune that as to who set it in motion, right? Because that's another way of looking at it. In the Aristotelian way of thinking, that the God was sort of had angels moving those galgals all the way around, which is sort of the way that Rambam is presenting it. Yeah, to us, it's profoundly is who put it all into motion that it's perfectly attuned. He had no one teaching him, no one explaining to him davar. He was involved with polytheists who lived in this place called Ur Kasdim. So he was among these people. He was an idol worshiper until his heart found the truth. And he got to the correct line through his own consideration. And he knows that there was this creator. Avraham Avinu arrived at God by looking inside ultimately. He looked at the world as a large, but ultimately where did it come from? A deep realization and contemplation. If you think about this is interesting, is as opposed to that article we read beforehand, where you're confronted with difficulties, what do? We do lateral thinking. What was Avraham doing? Avraham Avinu was the exact opposite. He was sort of penetrating the problems that he had to deal with. And that's how he discovered Hashem. The way it's written in Hasidic literature, a very famous work, which is said in the Sas Emes, I put it over here. The Sas Emes says, Lech Lecha was not a command to Avraham Avinu. This is the Sas Emes, the most profound words. Lech Lecha was a call to humanity, but there was only one human listening. Is that unbelievable? Lech Lecha was a call. It was a call to say to humanity, folks, I need somebody to take up my banner, to listen to my mission. You know what? There was only one person who was adjusting themselves to that wavelength to be able to pick up the message, and that was Abraham. Is that fascinating? That's the way that Chassidus looks at it. Meaning, how did he get there? It was because he was attuning himself. He was working on actually dealing with the issues of life, to be in life where he was, to think, to hear. Very fascinating. But now, if you want to take this a little further, what Rabbi Kaplan argues, and this is not him arguing, but this is the Rishonim who argue this, is ultimately, if you think about it, we have this conception that what's Nevuah? Nevuah is you know, one morning, Jeremiah wakes up, he turns on his AOL, he hears the little bing, you've got mail, God says, tell the world it's going to be doomsday tomorrow, and that's an end. And Jeremiah now comes to the people, and they say, Jeremiah, we heard you yesterday, we don't want to hear you again. But Jeremiah got this mail from God, and he reads out the email, and everybody hears what God has to say. That's nothing to do with prophecy, actually. If you read what, we're not going to go through it in actual inside, just because for the sake of time, but the way the Rambam describes prophecy, the way the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, describes prophecy, is it wasn't God sending you mail. It wasn't God giving you a message to the world. You know what prophecy was? We described this a little bit when we went through the Yigdal Karim in the summer. Prophecy was a person who spent their life trying to remove themselves, meaning trying to remove their ego from life and have a connection with God. Spend time contemplating the divine. In a certain sense, the way Ari Kaplan said, now just importing the word, meditating, focusing, concentrating on the divine, and removing the ego necessary to be able to have that focus. And maybe someday, after years, maybe even after decades of practice, after work on oneself, maybe God would sometimes say, you're worth the conversation, and God would drop in and there'd be a communion. God wouldn't say to him, now this is what you've got to do. The messages that God gave were byproducts of the communion. When God had an interaction with a person, when there was this divine communion, because a person had worked for years to cleanse themselves, we'll call it non-judgmental, removing their experience and their projection into the experience, and God decided to have an interaction with them, at that point in time, they suddenly had a vista into the divine, into domains and, we'll call it, realms, which are well beyond the five senses that we have. And as part of that, they also understood certain things that would happen about the future, and some of them were incumbent upon them to tell. But that was as a byproduct of their relationship, which was created through their focus of years. This is what prophecy was. It wasn't simply telling stories, because that's the way we think about it, or providing messages. Ilana, there's a thought?
I just wanted to say that I personally feel that every time you have a new child brought into the world, there's a family, particularly the mother, has that spark. There is a moment, or several moments, especially in the first, days, where you feel such a powerful connection to Hashem that I think that is an opportunity for all of Klal Yisrael to experience sparks.
You're absolutely right. So there are times, you see, right now, we're in a historic period where there's prophecy. And you're right, today we have an eclipse from prophecy, which we're going to get to in just a second, and there are moments where we are able to reconnect and to appreciate this. You see, what I just wanted to do is, before we even get to today, is just to appreciate the fact that when you read Tanakh, and you read what's going on, and prophecy, and you read what's going on with Avraham Avinu, and you try to understand what's going on, before we get to our age, you just to appreciate the fact that this is what was going on. Forget mindfulness, forget Eastern meditation. Just think about what was going on in Judaism. How did these people find their connection with God? It was a full and 100% connection of inviting in the divine into a mindful state of non-judgmental experience of Hashem without any sense of ego. That's what's going on. You read the Ramchal, it's as if they translated some of his words, and of course with modifications and different results, into some of the literature that you're reading today. Now, your point is well taken, is so what happened? Meaning, we don't have that anymore. So did meditational thinking sort of drop off? And the answer is absolutely not. Fascinating enough, listen to the way that Rabbi Kaplan describes this. We're going to skip a little bit of this. By the way, you might think, you say, well, that was for the prophets, right? So Jeremiah, Amos, Hosea, Ezekiel, right? So they were great at this, right? So the rest of society, isn't it a little bit narrow thinking to say that society was, very aware of God in this way, and they all spent their time focusing on what they were doing and experiencing God. That was for the special people. So you read the Gemara in Megillah, it actually says that there were many, 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 many prophets. In fact, the Gemara says, that it's the way it describes it was Kiflaim Kiyotze Mitzrayim. We're talking about at least 1.2 million prophets in Jewish history. That's a lot of prophets, right? So that's, there were academies of prophets. In fact, the Ramchal says there are many people who practiced their whole lives and never got divine communion. They never got themselves perfected to the point of the divine having a communion with them. This is something prolific in all of society. So now, let's take this a little first. So prophecy ends. When does prophecy end particularly?
The beginning of
the second commonwealth, the beginning of Bayis Sheni. How do we find that out, by the way? Very simple. If we look in Tanakh, we see where it ends, right? So who are the last prophets? The last prophets is Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi. Malachi is the end of the Treyasar, that's the end of Nevi'im. And you've got the end of the Ksuvim, who's the last person to be speaking? Ezra, right? Ezra Sofer is the last person speaking. Of course, he was also somebody who came back in the Second Commonwealth from Persia to Judea and reestablished the Second Commonwealth, so the Beis Hamikdash was built. In fact, Chazal actually aligned those two people, saying Malachi and Ezra were in fact the same person, according to one man, Amar. But we know when it happens because we see when Tanakh stops talking, right? And so we're talking, we know pretty much when that happens, how far in is a matter of debate. But nonetheless, what happened afterwards? So what happened? You have these people who try to sort of get this sense of the divine, where did it go? What happened afterwards? Listen to what the way Rabbi Kaplan describes it in Source 12 on page 10. He says, second paragraph, very interesting point. He says, the great assembly, that we talk about, Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, they were the body that included the last prophets. They included people like Mordechai, people like Ezra, people like the tail end, Shimon HaTzadik, who became the beginning of the Mishnah. Right, that was the transformative council, which is the transition point of Judaism from prophecy to wisdom. And in that great assembly also realized that the general populace would need a meditative discipline. But rather than have it something loose and unstructured, they needed a discipline with a structure common to the entire Jewish nation, one that would serve as a means of uniting the people. It would have to contain the hopes and aspirations of the nation as a whole to reinforce the unity of the Jewish people. Because remember now, we're at a point where there's less of a... They've seen what 70 years in Babylonian / Persian exile has been. They've seen that they don't have a king now. They're a Persian vassal state, even as a second commonwealth of the Beis Hamikdash. They need to have something unifying that everybody can abide by. The meditative discipline that was composed by the Great Assembly ended up as the Amidah, a standing prayer consisting of 18 sections, which would be repeatedly repeated silently in an upright position 3 times a day. It is true that nowadays the Amidah is thought of more as a prayer than a meditative device, but the most ancient sources regard it as a meditation. Indeed, the Talmud verifies that this was its original intention. This also explains why the Great Assembly legislated the same prayer be repeated 3 times a day. People often complain that saying the same prayer over and over is tedious and uninspiring. For anyone familiar with mantra meditation, however, the opposite is true. All types of mantra meditation involve repetition. In mantra meditation, the device repeated in a word or phrase, and it can be repeated over and over for weeks, months, or even years on end. The Amidah was meant to be repeated 3 times a day from childhood on, and essentially the same formula would be said for an entire lifetime. The Amidah could therefore be looked at as upon as one long mantra. In many ways, it has the same effects as a mantra, lifting the individual to a high meditative state of consciousness. As we shall, there is an entire literature that describes how the Amidah can be used in this manner, and he goes on to do it. He goes through paragraph by paragraph to try to appreciate what's supposed to be achieved in each section. And he goes on to describe how a lot of the words, when we read halacha, actually, are referring to this. What happens? Anshei Knesset Gedolah said, let's understand. We've lost this ability to be able to perfect ourselves, to get this sense of focus that will allow prophecy in. So what are we going to do? We're going to create a universal way of focus, which is going to happen 3 times a day, and you're going to have to do this to be able to access, again, that thoughtfulness. Now imagine if you thought about it this way. Imagine that instead of thinking about, oh, what wouldn't it be nice if I had time just to focus and sort of align myself every day, but I don't have time for it. We do! You come to a shul, and you sit in shul, and you have a moment to actually just think, just to be able to focus one's mind. Now, I admit that some shuls and some inyanim are not geared towards the time spent necessarily to be able to appreciate what's really going on over here. But nonetheless, imagine that you were to actually take the time and sort of start just focusing, before you start focusing just on your breathing for 5 seconds. Feel yourself in the room. Feel yourself grounded in the place where you are. And start now sort of slowly think through the words that you're saying. Imagine what's going on over here. This is not Eastern, this is Jewish, right? If you think about it, actually, if you just as an example, lehalacha. He has just the first sif in Shulchan Aruch. This is plain, black on white Shulchan Aruch. Okay, Rav Moshe Isserles says in the first sif in Shulchan Aruch, Haga Shivisi Hashem lenegdi tamid. I focus on God in front of me always. What does that mean? It's a pasuk. That's on many of the amudim and shuls. You'll see that pasuk inscribed. Okay, who klal gadol b'Torah? It's a great rule in the Torah. Over manas atzadikim asher holchin ifnei Elokim, among the righteous who walk in front of God. Ki en yeshiva sa adam v'tnuah sa v'asakov u'levado b'beis. So there's no time that a person, even when they're alone in their house, yeshivasa v'tnuah sa v'asakov u'levado b'melech gadol. There's no comparison if one is aware that one's in the presence of the Almighty. V'lo yediburoi v'harchavas piv kiritzonai. You're not going to speak to your family in the same way if you realize that you're in the presence of the Almighty, of a great king. When a person focuses their heart, Hashem is watching your actions. There's this focus that a person is supposed to maintain throughout one's life. The Be'er Halacha, the Chofetz Chaim, who comments on this halacha, says, and again, this is la halacha. He quotes in the Be'er Halacha that there are 6 mitzvahs tamidios. There's 6, we'll call it latent foci, that are supposed to be in our lives. We're supposed to be thinking about the 6 mitzvahs, which is to love Hashem, to fear Hashem. He goes through the, we'll call it latent consciousness that we're supposed to be aware of, that's supposed to pervade our lives. Other examples, Siv Dalad in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch says, Tov ma'at me'ek tachanoni b'kavona, me'arbos b'loik ha'bakavona. When it comes to their supplications, extra prayers, right? Not this ma'amira. When it comes to extra prayers, let's say slichos. When it comes to saying tehillim, when a person is saying extra prayers, the rule of thumb is tov ma'at b'kavona. A little bit is better when intended. The word kavona, as Rabbi Kaplan explains on the previous page, we didn't go through that section. Kavona is a mind focus. That's one of those words that we kind of lost track of what it means. Kavona is focus of the mind. Right? That's exactly what it means. It's meditative practice of being able to focus what's going on. A little bit is better with kavana than lots without kavana. I remember one Rosh Hashanah, I was in Neri Yisrael, and there's a halacha on Rosh Hashanah, one of the many halachas of Rosh Hashanah, is that one's supposed to finish the book of Tehillim on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Right? This is a halacha. So I was in Yeshiva, And I went up to Rav Einstadter. Rav Einstadter is the second year Rebbe. He is, you know, when you say the word kol kulai, that means, you know, he is totally Torah. There's not an element of his life which isn't. He is a very unique person. He's sort of an anomaly in America. You don't see people like that around. He really just lives Torah all the time, every breathing moment. And I remember I went up to him and I said to him, you know, Rebbe, what, you know, is it better? I've now 45 minutes before Mincha. Is it better that I charge through and I just get through to him to be able to finish it like the halacha says, right? And, you know, I won't necessarily understand fully, or to just take a few and slowly think about them. And he looked at me like really confused, but like genuinely confused. And he said, I don't understand. Is there any time in your life you do something that you don't understand? He couldn't understand the notion of asking a question about trying to do something which wasn't where you understand what you're doing properly. He just that's Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says if you have a choice, and it's going to be one or the other. Remember, these are mutually exclusive options. Then what's one supposed to be doing? Is one supposed to have the kavon to understand what one's doing? That's what's achieving things. More than that, when you think about, let's say for instance, the halacha about kavona. What is one supposed to be thinking about when one does Shmoneh Esrei? La halacha, halacha la ma'aseh. What is one supposed to be thinking about during Shmoneh Esrei? You know, let's say you are now the most advanced, you know, you've ever been in your life in terms of halacha, in terms of machshava, in terms of kabbalah. What should you be thinking during Shmoneh Esrei? So you think lofty ideas, you know, you think about the merkava and ma'aseh bereishis, and you know, we're talking about, you know, esoteric ideas which are, you know, the worlds joining and, you know, the celestial beings all coming into alignment as you're saying your Shmoneh Esrei, and you read Shulchan Aruch, and Shulchan Aruch doesn't say that. The Shulchan Aruch says in Siman Tzariches, again, this is Rav Yosef Karo. His next door neighbor, of course, was Arizal, right? But he's writing halacha, and he says the following. He says, sorry, this is in source 16. He says, "Sarech shi'ye loy kavona b'tzilosa." What's the halacha? He says in Sif Aleph, "Hamispalel, sarech shi'achavim b'liboy pirosh hamilos shemotzi b'sasav." So simple, and it's such an unbelievable halacha. What are you supposed to be thinking about? Think about the words you're saying. You're not trying to get to outer space in your brilliance and your intellectual prowess about understanding all the dimensions of a word in string theory, because that's what you're trying to achieve. What's happening over here is you're simply grounded in understanding what you're saying. And if we read halacha once again, just with this sense and realize that this was written in the 1500s. Okay, so we're talking about, you know, this the practice that we're talking about over here is you just need to understand what we're doing. Think about the Shmoneh Esrei as a moment where we can actually focus, when our lives are not frenetic for just a moment, to be able to just ground ourselves and think, what are we doing? What am I saying? How is what I'm saying reflecting on my life? How is what I and allowing it in non-judgmentally to allow those words to flow through one? This is mainstream halacha if we read it as such, if we're able to appreciate this. This is why when you read through a book like Jewish Meditation, like Rabbi Ari Kaplan, he allows you to open up halacha and read it again and carefully understand what's really going on in halacha. Very, very, very beautiful insight. The other dimension, of course, over here, what Anshe Knesset HaGdolah did was not just for that little bit of time that we start in the morning, we interrupt our afternoon for, and we close our day with. Right? Though that the day is framed in this meditative place where we're able to actually appreciate what's going on in our lives. I apologize, we're going a little late. If anyone needs to write, I apologize. I just want to conclude on one particular point. There's another aspect of what Anshe Knesset HaGdolah did. Let's take a look at the Gemara. The Gemara itself describes this very carefully. The Gemara says, let's just take back for one moment, a one-line Gemara in Brachos. Gemara in Brachos says on source 11, bottom of page 9, Amalahen, Rav Shmon bar Abba, Rabbi Yochanan, Michti Anshe Knesset HaGdolah, Tiknu Lehem Yisrael, Brachos, Tfilos, Kedushos, Havdolos. What were the things that they instituted? Not only the Tfilos, but also the Brachos. If we think about what a Bracha is, this is just a remarkable idea. Let's think about what a Bracha is. A Bracha is essentially not simply in the state where we prepare our day, interrupt our day, or conclude our day. It's every aspect of our day. Imagine, you know, you go to the bathroom, right? You walk out and you declare to God in front of Kisei Kvodecha, right? In front of His throne, what you just did, right? That you understand what's happening over here? Whether it be Nehenin, what I'm about to encounter when I'm about to eat, I'm about to experience what I'm about to eat, when I'm about to perform an action which is a godly action, a mitzvah, but when I'm about to reflect on an aspect of his world, I'm seeing the sea, I'm seeing the mountains, I'm seeing beautiful things in the world. What am I doing? I'm refocusing myself through those events. The bracha is simply that node in the day where we refocus what we're doing. That's exactly what the bracha is actually effectively achieving. That was what Anshe Kinesadola said. Listen to the way that Rabbi Lau puts us in the sages. Just such a beautiful way of describing it. He quotes our Gemara, source 19, and he says the following. He says, this sentence from the Talmud, that Gemara in Brachas we just read, embodies a wealth of material concerning the activities of the men in the Great Assembly. The single phrase, blessings and prayers, encompasses almost the entirety of our religious world. Can a person be religious without reciting blessings and prayers? Our daily routine is almost inconceivable in the absence, since one's entire daily connection to God is summed up in these two words, blessings and prayers. Without a blessing or prayer, we have no stable meeting point with God. We are left only with our spontaneous overtures at times of grace or joy or, heaven forbid, crisis. The men of the Great Assembly understood that the life of simple people far from the temple, a rural farmer perhaps, had no spiritual dimension or possibility of touching the holy. They saw that only by formalizing the relationship between the individual and his creator would all people have access to their inner spiritual lives. Prayer and blessings introduced a framework of basic religious consciousness into the religious world of the layman. This was a revolution that called upon every Jew to participate actively in the service of God, rather than simply to rely on the knowledge that sacrifices were being offered in the temple on his behalf. So your whole day is framed. Every activity is being framed. I want to leave you with a little bit of homework, though, on this notion. There is no bracha on one section of life. What section of life does not necessitate a bracha? We talk about everything we're about to eat and enjoy. We talk about mitzvahs we're about to perform. We talk about responding to stimuli and the beauty of the world around us. And those things are all nodes or moments of, we'll call it, awareness, where you can feel God in some way, right? Experiences in life like Ilan was talking about. But where is there not brachas afforded? Ben Adam, the chavera. Do you notice that you don't say brachas primarily on many mitzvahs, ben Adam, the chavera? You have to sort of think about that, what that means, why that's true and how that relates to this. In this particular, many answers offered, but how this relates to this. If you think about this, this is the way that Rav Hirsch describes in the 18th source. We're not going to read it inside, but he points out that the Gemara Brachos says, "Man debayi lemehave chasira." You want to become a person who goes the extra mile, going to come close to God. A person should look into the mile de brachos. A person should be aware of everything they're doing through the medium of those brachos. And we'll close with the last verse of Rav Hirsch, where he talks about this month itself. He says the following in source 20. Every month of the Jewish calendar year has received from Jewish law or from Jewish history some unique characteristic by which it makes its own special impact upon our minds and our spirits. Mar Cheshvan is the only month that has not been favored with such a gift. While the preceding month offered us so many deeply stirring days designed to bestir us with solemnity and rejoicing and generated an abundant treasure of mitzvahs whose truths and from the very foundations of our lives, Mar Cheshvan has no other message for us except that, after a month of such an abundance of special days, we should start out on the everyday path of Jewish life. However, it is the routine of everyday life which reflects our true existence, preceding and following those festivities from which they receive their value and significance. The Jewish life for the next 5 months, with the exception of Chanukah and Purim, is just about the day-to-day grind. But it's not about the day-to-day grind. Because if we frame it with the way Anshe Kinesadola framed it, it's about experiencing every moment. Every time we walk outside and we feel the breeze on our cheeks. Every time we're about to eat something and we think for a moment, we're eating, we're enjoying it. We go to the restroom and we appreciate that the body functions, thank God. We go in the morning and before we go into a crazy day, we stop and say, wow, what is Hashem's agenda for me today? What's my agenda going to be in the world today? That's the type of life that the Mar Cheshvan Jew participates in. And the beautiful thing is, this terrifying thing is, Noach was not a Mar Cheshvan Jew. Noach was the person who was the man who fought when the world was being destroyed. He was the man who was different. He fought all the waves of time. He walked out into normal life and he failed. The test for us is to be the person who's able to go into the regular life and be able to appreciate it, to be grounded in it. I hope this is an interesting introduction to perhaps a much, much larger topic.